Hello and welcome to Persiflage number 24. That is the 24th Persiflage podcast that we've done. I'm reading aloud all the issues of the old Persiflage magazine, which was published in the early 2000s. And I noticed that this one has no date, number 24. So, it was published sometime in 2001, and if you're really, really curious, you could go back and listen to the date of Persiflage number 23, merely by visiting persiflagepress.com, and then going to the podcast page, and then finding the 23rd one, and then clicking on that, and listening to even just the first probably 30 seconds. And that'll give you the date of Persiflage number 23. And then you would add 7 to that for one full week. And that would be the date for Persiflage number 24. Or, for those of you who don't give a shit, you could skip all of those stages and just listen to this. So here we go. Persiflage number 24. And the first piece is called Lost Words, Expressions That Never Caught On or Fell Into Almost Immediate Disuse. So, that could be interesting. One of the great things about the past is that all those people are dead, and we can make fun of all their ridiculous clothing styles, systems of government, forms of entertainment, and moribund religions with impunity. And unless I miss my guess, we all find extinct slang hilarious. For instance, who doesn't find himself or herself chuckling when they think about the fact that children used to be referred to as spurtons in the 16th century in England, or that buggery used to be called gomorami? Now, don't go putting those two together, or you'll have the RCMP down on us faster than you can say, "Clear this roadway." I personally cannot resist giggling when I think that in early Puritan New England, a lady's comb was called a straightener, and a chair was a set-a-piece. Wonderfully straightforward folks, those Puritans. In the Old West, regions west of the Mississippi, circa 1865 to 1890, a revolver that fired 6 shots was called a six-shooter, while a man who drank too much was called a squirrel jockey. The origin of the first epithet should be fairly obvious. The second began with an infamous bout of drinking by the least known of the James brothers, that's Frank and Jesse, not William and Henry. The youngest of the James brothers, Wally, was known for his ability to drink and also his willingness to take any kind of bet, no matter how unsound, especially if he was drinking heavily. Apparently, Wally, on one of his more serious binges, was challenged to ride the smallest animal in the livery stable. Unbeknownst to the pickled James, the keeper of the livery stable, Old Gabby, who was referred to by that name because he was well over 70, an advanced age in that era, and due to his fondness for chewing the fat. Anyway, Old Gabby kept a pet squirrel named Snippy due to his unpleasant disposition in the morning before his coffee. The rest of the story is more or less obvious. I'm sorry, what were we talking about? Hubris. Next up is a poem by the less than renowned French poet Charles Rochebeaubois, entitled Bridging the Distance, which I assume is translated from the French. Now that there is occasionally some space between us, and the spanning of it takes a long walk and a bus or two, I find closing it that much more satisfying, especially those last, I won't say few, inches. Okay. And now we have a story entitled A Roommate Story. So, presumably it's about someone's roommate. I'm just guessing. Certain things are better left unsaid, thought Ronald, as he finished cleaning himself, and I must bear that in mind. Lately, he had been having some difficulty in refraining from mentioning to his roommate a few things that had been troubling him. Number one on this list was the fact that Derek, Ronald's roommate, had all but ceased buying tuna. This, in itself, was cause for alarm as far as Ronald was concerned, but perhaps even more disconcerting was the fact that Derek had taken up Morris dancing. Now, it was not that Ronald had a problem with Morris dancing per se. In fact, he himself had once dabbled in that lively art, although his attraction to it had been mostly due to the darting movements of the brightly colored ribbons. Ronald's problem sprung from the awful realization that Derek had absolutely no aptitude for dance. He was positively arrhythmic, and so his frenzied, out-of-whack leapings were disrupting to Ronald's aesthetic sense, to say nothing of his nap times. But Derek was a sensitive soul, and his feelings were easily hurt, and Ronald knew that he had only taken up Morris dancing out of an overwhelming sense of loneliness, in the hopes of meeting women. So despite the daily discomfort that Derek's practice sessions were causing him, Ronald felt he could say nothing. One day, Derek came home after class and flopped into the big velvet easy chair by the door, looking very morose. His ribbons flopped with him. Ronald sidled up and rubbed against his legs in an effort to get him to open up and talk about whatever was troubling him, and also to remind him that there was no food in his bowl. Derek looked down at him. "Ronald," he said, "I'm giving up Morris dancing." Ronald tried not to look too pleased. He pretended to have discovered something stuck in his paw in order to hide his grin. "I'm just no damn good at it," he said. "And besides," he paused, "I think the only single girl there," he paused again, "is insane." Ronald wondered what could have led Derek to this conclusion. As he did not know the girl, he couldn't speculate. And as he was a cat, he knew that although Derek was inclined occasionally to direct comments his way when he was feeling particularly cheerful or depressed, he seldom provided him with a full explanation of things. He had heard Derek mention Anna from time to time, but he had never heard him say anything to lead him to doubt her mental stability. He had never heard Derek say that Anna wore a tinfoil hat or believed herself to be the rightful heir to any foreign throne. He'd also never heard him speak of any episodes in conjunction with her name. To Ronald, this sudden revelation of Derek's was a mystery. To be continued. And that story was by Frank Speaking. Well, I wonder when it is continued. Possibly next week. Who knows? And now, the quotations, which this week have the tagline, "Ah, yes, the quotations as usual." "The only pain that can be avoided is the pain that comes of trying to avoid pain," R.D. Lang. "For a long time now, I have been judging people on the basis of minute details. I'm sorry to say I cannot wait for the big events in life through which they reveal themselves." Peter Altenberg. "If a writer has to rob his mother, he will not hesitate. The ode on a Grecian urn is worth any number of old ladies." William Faulkner. Classifieds. "For sale, very small set of cat's clothing, derby hat, red silk vest, RAF tie, and socks, etc., worn by previous owner only once a year for veterans' reunion. Very good condition. Reply to Box 142. "Tired of working for a living? Interested in big money and a life of leisure? Travel to exotic locales for heavy lounging? Me too." "Man with badger fixation seeks woman with badger fixation. Object swapping badger stories and photos. Reply to Box 756. And that's it. That was Persiflage number 24. Tune in next week and perhaps we'll hear the exciting conclusion of Ronald and Derek's Morris dancing story. Then again, maybe we won't. Okay, that's it. Goodbye.